Chink, chink, bling, bling. Let's cut the chatter. In today's episode, money, money, money. Not so funny. Welcome to the Tucci Talks Wealth, Health, and Everything Else podcast. I'm your host, David Tucci, an educator, a father of three. Join me as I take you on a funky journey through life, from a reckless young man to a humbled older man. Each week, I will offer different insights on my life experiences and the experiences of others and how that has shaped our present day realities. So let's begin our funky journey into improving our health, wealth, and you guessed it, everything else. Monday, 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 it's not Sunday, time for Tucci Talks. Monday, 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 it's not fun day, time to go to work. Welcome again, everybody, to another episode of Tucci Talks, Wealth, Health, and Everything Else. Today, we are going to work. We will be focusing on the financial system, how money works. Hopefully, we can synthesize this information because it is so much to process. We are gonna try to get it into bite-sized chunks. Before I begin, happy Halloween to all the listeners out there. It was a tough one for the kids because there were no kids in my neighborhood. It was a dead zone. But on a positive note, our SO streak goes to three as my good friend David from Etobicoke guest Katrina and the Waves walking on sunshine. He asked me if he gets a Tucci Talks mug. I said, those mugs are earned, brother. That's the problem with society today. They want something for nothing. No free lunches.
Kipper.
What better way to get than with some cash? And that's what we're going to be discussing today. A basic understanding on how this financial system works. So get your popcorn ready. As usual, let's take an important look back at last week's episode. What did I learn from having Tamara on the podcast last week? Well, philosophy really is fundamental. Doing philosophy entails challenging views. It is imperative to steep your views in acid. Let them stay a while and let the acid eat away at those beliefs. But please, let those beliefs get exposed to rigorous testing. If and only if they still hold, retain those beliefs. If they get eaten away, just discard those beliefs. That, friends, is the acid test. Why do we need a new hair law to protect people from race-based hair discrimination? Why do we get offended when I send out an article titled "A Linguistics Love Letter to Profanity Explains Why It's Fine to Curse Around Kids"? I've had some guests on here that have discussed this European or patriarchal or other dominant model for ideal behavior. We seem to measure people with this yardstick and then condemn them for falling short, further confirming the conviction that the current model is superior. I'm part of that system. I probably was that guy that would get offended by profanity in a professional setting. If you listened to last week's episode, Tamara put me on the spot by essentially laughing at my suggestion. But I'm glad she did, because I put that viewpoint to the acid test, and that view got eaten away. I encourage you to check out the profanity article. I put it on the website, TucciTalks75.com, under the philosophy episode. It really is important to feel safe when having these types of discussions. And I'm happy that guests that come on here understand that, and they understand that Tucci Talks is a brave space. We are heading into another brave space right now, as it is time for me to introduce today's guest. I have known this individual for over 25 years. He currently works as a senior capital market professional. He has advanced knowledge and direct experience with trading and portfolio management, exotic and structured fixed income and equity derivatives, advanced institutional investment strategies, spot and future markets, and risk management. He has also an advanced skill set in bridging the gap between theoretical frameworks and pragmatic risk and investment strategies. To further add, he has an advanced ability in original idea generation, conceptual design, and the execution required for successful business initiatives. In other words, he's pretty funky cool. It is with admiration that Tucci Talks welcomes Antonio Girardi. Okay, so welcome to Tucci Talks. I appreciate you coming on today, and happy Halloween. You know, part of me thinks this episode may have to be a two-parter, and we revisit this again in the future. The reason why I say this is because my mind's all over the place when it comes to finance and economics. Add a pinch of politics, gently stir with people's ignorance, and you have one big mess. And I want to simplify and give clear direction, but there's just so many moving parts. And my hope is that you can do that for us today and simplify this mess with your background in finance. And if I can start, I just want to share a brief story that relates to your professional background. We were discussing this years ago, and you told me one time that you had to make a choice with your career. You either go to the quote dark side, end quote, or you leave the institution where you worked. Can you give a bit of clarity to the listeners as to what you meant by that? I think this is a good place to start.
First, I want to start off by saying thanks for welcoming me here, Dave. I appreciate the opportunity to chat about finance. It's a field that I'm somewhat passionate about. So please stop me if I start going down a rabbit hole or if I get a little bit too excited.
We love people's passion on here. That's what makes it.
Yes. So just want to start off by saying everything I'm going to share with you today is my opinion. It doesn't represent any firms that I've worked for or that I'm currently working for. I'm also covered by non-disclosure agreements for institutions that I work for. I'm currently engaged in a contract with a Canadian financial institution.
Oh, this is getting serious already.
It is, and you know what?
This is getting serious.
You know, that's why I usually find that I'm one of the few people that enjoy talking finance, because it is such a serious topic.
And oh, man.
It touches on so many aspects of our lives, whether we agree with the system or whether we don't agree with the system. We all have to live in the system.
Agree.
That's part of why, you know, when you asked me if I can come on and chat about finance, I said, sure, yes, definitely. But there are aspects of the system that we can touch on later. But part of the reason why I have to give this disclaimer is, with any legal contract, you're obligated to do certain things or obligated not to do certain things. And, you know, this whole social media realm, we'll call it, has really created some confusion. The law or legal contract usually lag behind technology, we'll call it. So very interesting.
You know what? I'm sure the listeners appreciate that. We're going to do our best here. That's all we could do today. Oh,
definitely. And so I just want to put that out there, but I also wanted to put it out for you and your listeners that if I have to shy away from a question, it's not because I'm being coy or I don't want to answer it.
Okay.
It's because there are legal implications to what I say, and it's more of the non-disclosure agreements, but I don't think we're going to be touching on that. So I can probably speak very freely with you and your audience.
Can you talk about that story that I just said, or no?
I can, definitely. And it's actually part of the dark side, or it can be part of the dark side. So I've spent over 20 years in finance. So I've spent time in retail banking within one of the larger Canadian banks, you know, dealt with clients at the retail level, wealth management, went over into the pension industry, one of the larger Canadian pension plans. Now I'm doing contract work, more on the technology side, with one of the larger Canadian FIs.
Okay.
The reason I say that is when I...
FIs when, is when financial... Sorry to interrupt, just because we're lay people. We're not like you. FI, financial institution?
It is, yes.
Okay. I just want to clarify for the lay people like myself. And I appreciate your expert knowledge.
You stop me because when you work in the field for so long, you start tend to adopt industry jargon that.
Totally.
And it's actually one thing that I've been fighting a lot through my career because I've always wanted to get into a specialty where, you know, certain fields, there's the people's experts, but then there's the experts, you know, the people that really, even the people doing their job look to for some more expertise.
Right.
That's a level that I always wanted to achieve. Whether I've gotten there or not, it's a different question. But
so what's the dark side? I'm curious. What's this dark side?
Dark side is, generally speaking, anything that calls your ethics, morals into question.
And were your ethics, morals called into question? I'm assuming yes.
They are. And the challenge becomes, you know, within the space of ethics or morals, it's very personal, right? What I consider ethical behavior, you may not consider ethical, and vice versa.
What would be an example?
Often the very the pragmatic aspects are, is a statement misleading or not?
Okay.
So when you start getting into sales.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No. So when you start getting into the sales side of it, that's really where I see more of the dark side, is where what message and what's the sales pitch that's being used to drum up the business.
So do you believe that, do you believe we're being caught like the average person, middle-class people just want to go to work, pay their bills. Are we getting conned to some degree?
I believe so.
Okay. Okay.
That's the blunt answer. And the dark side is how long can you resist? Or how long do you have the energy? Because it does wear on you when, you know, you're the odd person out, or at least you feel like you're the odd person out. A lot of this is perception.
Right.
I think there are a lot of decent people. So I don't want to paint the financial institution space, the whole industry, as something bad. I don't think it's bad. It's just like anything in life. You're going to have your bad apples and you're going to have your good apples.
But then you made a decision at that point when we had that conversation to leave. Yes.
It was just, it was more of a personal decision because one promise I made myself, I always think back to, you know, what if it was my mother coming into the branch or needed this financial information? What if it was a close family member, a friend? That's kind of how I kept myself true to my ethics and morals, is to say, well, what I'm telling the client in front of me, whether I know them, whether I like them, whether I dislike them, whatever my personal opinion of these people are, am I holding true to what my ethics and morals and, you know, how I was raised and what I consider to be ethical behavior?
Right. Right.
And oftentimes I found that it got called into question. You know, this is the business side. You're hired to do a certain job and it takes a lot of energy to stay true to yourself and holding yourself to that standard.
And that's why, Girardi, if I can just segue in, that's why I actually titled this episode. I like to try to give some catchy titles, but that's why I titled this episode Money, 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 Not So Funny. The reason I titled it that is because many think they know what money is until they really go down the rabbit hole. So I want to begin down this path with a quote from Henry Ford and kind of get your reaction. Quote, "It is well enough that people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system. For if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning," end quote. What are your thoughts on that?
I got to commend your research skills here, Dave. That's right on point. You know what? That's a very elegant and Ford put it very elegantly. Yes. I mean, that probably captures the spirit of the overall message.
I just want to say I had a conversation about this quote with an individual, and this person said they still wouldn't do anything because people are still comfortable. And until they're not comfortable, i.e. if I knew I wasn't getting food on the table in 6 months, that's the only way I'm going to act.
You know, there's also merit to that. You know,
okay.
I often try to take myself out of it and try to understand my biases. So I think Ford's quote is accurate in principle, in an ideology perspective. Now, most likely what your other person was referring to is human behavior.
Yeah.
You know, which is actually a reason I actually left the retail or client facing side of the business, because I think that comment also has validity in the concept that we all have the capacity to change.
Okay.
The part that really irks me and why I kind of left the client facing side of it is I had the impression in dealing with so many people, it gave me the perception that most people were not willing to change unless they really had to change. And almost to your comment, if you know that now all of a sudden the paycheck's not coming in, you have to change your lifestyle. I think this whole pandemic situation is really calling it to light, is it's forcing some people to have to change.
Right.
And change is always uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable. I know when I started, I go back to, you know, how I designed my learning path throughout my whole career and just personal growth. That's the one thing you have to get comfortable with really, really early in that process, because you're going to feel dumb. You're going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
Right. And then our ego gets in there, you get frustrated, and you're an educator, so you can probably speak to this more, but I think people forget how to learn or what the whole learning process is meant to achieve. Right.
Girardi, I can't tell you how amazingly ignorant we are. And even in an institution like education. Anyway, that was just, it's just frustrating. I know your frustration.
You know what? And I think I've spoken to other people that have the same opinion and view, share the same view of the world or principles. And what it ultimately comes down to is holding yourself accountable, which is also a big principle of mine.
And so what you're saying is it comes down to principles. You can't mandate integrity.
You can't. And I think it's, I've read so many things throughout my career and just personal growth, and it all comes, ultimately it comes down to you. I mean, whether you believe we have it kind of links to the Matrix. If you're a fan of the Matrix,
right?
At what level, at what level, you know, so do I. I just don't want to go off on a tangent because I still talk about it. I can talk about The Godfather. I can talk about there's so many lessons in these movies. But just on a lighter note, but it's that whole thing about at what level do we have or do we think we have a choice? And, you know, I'm of the belief that everything in life is a choice. So we are often faced with just a bad choice and a worse choice. But, you know, we always have a choice at the end of the day.
And that's well said. That's well said. And just to, I want to elaborate now, because I want to continue this interview to help the listeners where we're going with this. So with these ideas of we have choices and we have to be accountable to ourselves, I want to start getting under the hood. And you are the expert at this. You've been at it for a while now. Give us a behind the scenes view on how retail and institutional markets work and what the layperson should be looking for. Like how is this all connected? We're going to look, I want you to give us a basic view of the whole system from central banks down. I think that's a safe place to start. And I think you can help us with that.
Definitely. I mean, I'll skim over it. I mean, we can just pick out spots that you think are most interesting for you.
Perfect.
And listeners.
Perfect.
Because one thing I'll start off by saying is it touches on Ford's comment as well, is it's very complex. A lot of moving parts. But everyone can start off with just understanding, well, how is it you just built in concept?
And that's why I want you to be as simple as you can, because I've had discussions with you and we've gotten really extensive in our discussions, and that's way over my head. So I want to keep it as simple as we can, and I'm going to try to steer it best I can, and you do your best. That's all we're looking for today.
Sounds great, Dave. So you brought up the name central banks. You can think of it as, you know, the banks, basically. It's where do governments go to? Where do other banks go to for their funding needs? And by funding, I mean, anything that you do in your personal finances, conceptually, you can think of it in what I call institutional world. So we're in the institutional world now when we start talking about central banks and a bank's bank. It's retail investors don't have access to this part of it. So part of the
retail, who would retail investors be?
Easiest way to think of it is when you walk into your local branch.
Yeah.
You're a retail banker. You're a retail client.
Okay.
So you're there to buy products and services offered to retail clients.
Okay. So those banks are the retail.
No, those central banks are institutional. So the whole system can be broken out into institutional space.
Okay.
And a retail space. Retail space are the average Joes.
Okay.
Me, you know, your family. We need a financial services. We need to go for a mortgage. We need to, you know, select investment products.
Got you. That's the retail side.
That's the retail. The institutional space is the banks. Where do pension funds get their fundings? Where do hedge funds get their funding? It's the part of the markets that institutions go to. And that's basically how the names came about.
Okay.
It's, you know, institutional space, you know, it's kind of industry jargon, but it's well understood. It's the big broker dealers that offer, you know, if you're a mutual fund client or an actual mutual fund company, you're going to need services, right? You need trade execution. You're going to need reporting.
So could we focus? I don't think listeners are going to, not that it's unimportant, but it doesn't really resonate with them, the institutional side. So could we maybe focus more on this retail side that kind of will impact, like you said, the average Joe, me, you, families, et cetera.
You actually raised an interesting point. It's important to understand the institutional space.
Okay.
So everything in the system is correlated, and there's also causation. So think of it this way. You're going to have correlation. For those unfamiliar with it, it's just a statistical measure to say, if one thing happens, what's the association with something else?
Okay.
It doesn't give you the cause for it, but it just says, oh, when this thing goes up, something else goes up with it.
Okay.
That's correlation. Or something goes down. Causation is if you do A, B is going to happen. So those are two separate concepts, but there's definitely correlation and causation between the institutional space and the retail space.
So but then we need to know, what do we need to know about the institutional space? Because it sounds so complicated, like I said in the introduction, it really is. And we're trying to get this into palatable bites here.
I'll put it this way. The retail space is more of the day-to-day.
Okay.
But the institutional space, you still have to understand how the system is built. Because ultimately, then you'll understand why you're being perhaps pressured into buying a specific financial product. Well, why is the mortgage rate as high as it is at one financial institution, not the other? This all stems from the institutional space.
Okay, go for it.
So the basic concept is you'll have these institutions. So we're in the institutional space. You'll have the central banks. You have your governments. What the central banks do is they establish monetary policy. And it's a fancy way of saying you're trying to control the money flow in your system.
Is it safe to say like monetary policy is interest rates, raising, lowering, stuff like that?
That's one of the primary tools, yes.
Okay.
So if you ever hear, you know, you're listening to the news and you hear, oh, the Bank of Canada maintained its lending rate to 75 basis points. The central banks in Canada, it's called, you know, Central Bank of Canada.
Okay.
Every country maybe calls them differently. In the U.S., the Federal Reserve.
Right.
So they're different names, but general terminology is a central bank. And then what you precisely noted, their primary tool has historically been changing interest rates. And what that then does is it controls the money flow. And conceptually, think of it this way. If your mortgage rate is 10%, how likely are you to go out to get a mortgage?
Right.
You're less
right.
likely,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Exactly. As opposed to mortgage rates are 1%. That's really what the central banks are trying to do with monetary policy. They're either trying to stimulate growth. They're seeing that the economy is not growing as fast as they like. So what they'll say is they'll start lowering interest rates. It incentivizes people to then, oh, okay. Really what you're doing is conceptually it's, you're trying to have people not delay their purchasing decisions.
Right.
Right.
Getting them
you
to
know,
spend.
You want,
you're incentivizing you spending.
You are. And that's one that could be good or bad, because if you don't have a good control over your finances, you know, if you find it hard to save, invest, very enticing to say, well, you know, I can go into the bank today and get a 2% loan, and I can go buy the Corvette I always wanted,
yeah,
or the Porsche I always wanted.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know what, the carrying costs are low, but interest rates do fluctuate. And if it's a 10-year loan and it resets every year, well, that's where a lot of people get into trouble, is carrying costs. But I'm going a little off tangent, but that's basically what monetary policy is. You know, is how do you incentivize, or same thing with tax rules, it's how do you either get people to do something or not do something. And so, the way the central banks do it.
Go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
No, I was going to say the main tool that central banks use is by controlling the, that's why it's the interest rate set at the start of the whole process.
Now, people are, many people believe that ZIRP, which is zero interest rate policy, which we're at now, has created like the biggest misallocation of capital in human history. What do you say to that? Like, is it going to get worse having this environment of this ZIRP environment?
You just, with the ZIRP, and for those that aren't familiar with it, it's zero interest rate policy. So basically it's bringing the, that sent that rate that I'm talking about right now with central banks down to zero.
Yeah. That's what I said. Like, and we're at zero right now.
Correct. But, and that actually touches on, there's ZIRP and there's even, I mean, I'm more traditional. I don't think, I mean, to answer your question bluntly, I think ZIRP has created a mess.
Okay.
And it's really created an environment. And I want to be balanced in my response here. Post-financial crisis, the whole global financial system was put into a tailspin.
Just for people who don't know, 2008, the Great Recession you're talking now, post that, right?
Correct. And it was given a fancy marketing title by calling it the Great Recession. It's by all accounts, it was a depression. Just, it's not a good selling point to people to call it a depression. It creates that mental image. And it's always a balancing act because, and this is a very tough decision for anyone, is do you give information to people that might not be able to handle it in a very calm way?
Correct.
You know, I ultimately default to, I'm going to be as open as I can be. And then it's the person's own accountability to say how they react to that information. I'd rather be transparent.
I like that. That's fair.
It is. It's, and some people don't. And so that's where I'm saying, I think to be fair in that, fair in the comment about what central banks have done, and it was primarily the ECB, so the European Central Bank, that ventured off into this, so call them the guinea pig. They didn't Europe didn't recover to the same extent that North America did. So they were fine. They had their own challenges. So every economy is slightly different. And there's this broader concept about global integration versus how sovereign a country should be. And the challenge with Europe, the whole Eurozone, is when they created it, they had to give up some of their sovereignty in decision-making.
Right.
So I think that's why Europe was in a much, it's, think of it this way, try to get consensus amongst 30 people versus just five people. You're more likely to get consensus on, whereas with the five people, the 20 people are going to have different agendas, different interests, different reasons for why they come to a decision.
And giving up, for whatever, giving up sovereignty is a big issue. It's just like, if we could localize it, I know what's best for my, say, classroom, then the school board would know because I'm right there.
You know, that's a good analogy. It's follow-up question that to that would be, is by going the more sovereign route, how much of the benefits of a global system do you give up?
And or that's are we true willing too. To give up? Yeah.
Right. You know, often at the personal level, and what, you know, is to say, you know, global politics has taken a real left turn or right turn, however you want to call it. But if you want to hold true to whatever principle or belief system you have, how much are you willing to give up for it? And that's ultimately what, if you really believe in sovereign disintegration, let's get away from this global integration, are you willing to pay more for what you buy day to day?
Yeah.
So it's more to your question as saying, well, you know what, there's a concept of economies of scale. And if you're not familiar with it, basically what it says, if you buy something in larger volumes, you usually get it at a discount.
Right.
Fancy economic term for saying, if you buy something in large quantities, your unit price, how much you pay for every unit, is lower.
Go down.
It's a good deal. You know, it's like going to Costco versus going to retail, right? If you buy that 2-liter bin of tomatoes versus that small tin, per unit, you're paying less for the big one. So
So you said, sorry to interrupt you, but I want to try to keep us going and hit those important points. You said ZIRP, zero interest rate policy, has created a mess. Is it because we are now taking on way too much debt? I'm talking like consumers, us.
you can actually expand that. It's actually countries, institutions, us retail investors, or us retail clients. It's, think of it this way, at the end of the day, it's always people making these decisions. So the same things that we fall prey to personally, is the same politicians, central bankers.
So they're taking on too much debt. But then, Girardi, I don't know much about MMT. I was doing a little bit of research on it. Basically, modern monetary theory. I was reading a book by Stephanie Kelton. She's a advocate of it. She said that as long as you are the sovereign, the issuer of the currency, then you can print as much as you want. And the whole idea is just balancing the inflation. I don't want to get too much into it, but basically the principle is it's okay, print whatever you want, which gets us into this now. We're in a pandemic. Many millions of Americans and Canadians and people around the world are getting stimulus checks. As that dries up, so we get this money printing. Where I want to go with this, we get this money printing, but a minimal amount goes to people and a huge amount is going to these big institutions that are just buying more assets, propping up the stock market while the working guy is struggling or working family, they're struggling. And now their stimulus is going to dry up. Is this debt expansion going to destroy us?
History has shown us that, yes, it would. So it's, you know, I'm more in the stats field. So that's how I try to make my decision. And you know what, if evidence, there's a lot of evidence historically showing that whenever individuals, corporations, countries carry too much debt.
Okay.
It doesn't lead to good things, good outcomes. You can think of it from, for the average person, we'll say it this way. You have, let's say you start at the beginning of, you know, of your, the first time you ever got a credit card and you sort of take on some form of debt. Let's say you went and, you know, the limit was $20,000, you know, and that's kind of a reserve for you. You know, you use it for emergency purposes. You use it once, let's say there's an emergency. So now you use 10,000 of it. You only have 10,000 credit available to you. Something else comes, now you're 20. You've tapped out your access to credit, the borrowing.
Okay.
If something happens now in the future, how likely are you able to quickly address it through some reserve? If you've tapped out your 20,000, you can't apply for more credit. Now, what decision are you faced with?
Is that why the government has to do this kind of what we call this MMT, this helicopter money, to kind of bridge?
You know what? There's a segment of the market that thinks, and it's a loosely tied to what you've just quoted, is to say, well, if you do A, B, C, D, E, and F, then you know what? Your government can borrow as much as they want, and it really doesn't matter their debt to equity ratios. I'm not in that camp.
Okay.
I don't believe that is because there's always a debate between an industry. It's kind of the inside running joke. It's between academics and practitioners. You know, things look good on paper, then you go to execute things and they work out completely different. That's kind of the main punchline, is to say, yeah, you can make all sorts of assumptions and you think something's going to work out that way. It's based on research. And I actually lean on a lot of economic papers. That's where I get a lot of my source information. But ultimately, you have to be able to distinguish at some point, well, what looks good on paper and what's going to actually work in practice. You know, a lot of the economists, a lot of the academia, they downplay the behavioral aspect.
Right.
And actually the running joke within academia is if you do anything in the behavioral field, it's not a real field. You know, there's always a not, you know, it's that ego trip, right? There's always a pecking order, you know, in the medical field, you know, it's neurosurgeons and heart surgeons that are at the top of the pecking order, you know, but if you're a podiatrist, you're kind of way, you know, it's not,
it's crazy.
So it's the same concept, you know, it's, you have academia, you have all these highly intelligent people, but is that really how the world works?
Right.
And that's where you kind of take a step back and say, well, yeah, in concept, but can you run with the, one of the main assumptions that's almost by default in any of these research papers is that people make rational decisions.
Rational.
So it's rational. It gets fancier in terms of how they name it. You know, it's usually some form of utility function, they call it.
Okay.
And oftentimes what ends up happening is they make a very blanket type is to say, well, you, if you're rational, so you're going to try to maximize your utility for something. But let me ask, I'll put this out there, and it's part rhetorical, but it's how many times have you made a decision in your life just out of someone upset you? So you go make a decision, but you know, was that really irrational? Did it really maximize your utility, or did it actually hurt you? And actually that pegs on one of my, you know, I actually found the behavioral field very interesting. So I actually learned more on it. It's not, and I actually think it's a very important part of what I think finance people.
I think I'm going to get I think I'm going to get a behavioral expert potentially. I have a person in mind that works in finance in the bank.
You know what? I think that would be add a lot of value because I think it'll just expand on what I'm just casually touching on.
Yeah.
And I'm not an expert in that field. I just found it really fascinating and interesting on what explains why we do the things we do. And that's always just fascinated me because I saw even working in finance, and it goes back to my early days. I saw people in front of me where I'm providing them the best advice for what they've described they need, but they still go the other way. And that's part of what was very frustrating and why that area is to say, you know what, perhaps, you know, taking on this debt load and, you know, this is part of that ethics question where I can sell you whatever you came in for, but do I really think that you have the capacity? I mean, ultimately it's your decision, but if I've already seen that you're, you know, $50,000 into debt, you're coming in here because you want to go buy a car, you know, most people will just, sure, we'll do the loan application. And if it comes,
okay. So then let's move to that right now. Let's say you have me in this financial mess, in this crisis, and I come to you for advice and I want to represent just regular people. What do I do now today to help myself for the future? I'm in debt, let's say. I'm struggling, like many million. What's the unemployment rate in the U.S.? It's going past 30 million, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fairly high, and it's typically underreported just for the mechanics of how they report this. But to answer your question most directly, there's actually two parts.
Okay.
First part is just more of my own biases is, you know, you save for a rainy day. Before the rainy day happens.
Yeah, it seems like common sense sometimes.
Yeah, you know, there's that old saying, common sense is not that common.
I know, it's frustrating.
I bring it all back to, it's back to our human imperfections. And at times, you know, human imperfections are make us who we are, which is beautiful. But they also get us into the same, you know, if you're not cognizant, you know, how many people do you know that they always get themselves into the same situation. And and by that, I mean a negative situation. It's, you know, standing outside of you, say, well, doesn't so, you know, Dave,
don't
you see that you're,
yeah,
exactly. Right. It's that old, you know, there's a quote that keeps getting attributed to Einstein about, you know, what a definition of insanity. I don't know if he actually said it or not, but there's one definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results.
Right.
I just keep that as a little totem in the back of my head whenever I see myself getting into the same situation and it's not a positive outcome or the outcome I was looking for. Well,
this is the problem though, Girardi. We're dealing with a lot of people with also mental health issues that have to make these massive decisions for families. You see how complicated this is?
It is. And you know what? The more important the decision, usually the more complex it is because – you know, I usually, when I used to be in retail, I used to think of these anecdotes. You know, it's in terms of human generosity, I'll ask you this question. If you have a big pie in front of you, is it easier or harder to share a piece with someone else?
Right. So for me, it would be easier.
Exactly. And I'm of the same opinion, right? You know, there's 12 slices of pie there. What's giving away one? So it's easier for me to be generous. Now,
right.
Do I define myself as being generous? Well, the litmus test that I use is I only have one piece of pie left. You coming by and you saying, "Hey, Jordy, can I have half of that piece of pie?" Or maybe you're even more direct and say, "Can I eat that piece of pie there?"
Yeah.
Now, whether I give it to you or not, now that's my definition of whether I'm truly a generous person or not. And you know, my litmus test is I'm generous up to a point. You know, I try to be honest with myself. If that was the last piece of pie and I really wanted that pie and you came and asked me, Dave, you know, we've known each other for years, so maybe I'd give you a kind of a scoop or two. But
yeah, I like that. That's a really thorough, that's a good answer for people to understand. I like it.
No, and I use that for decision making as well, right? It's easy to be generous. It's easy to be honest when, you know, telling the truth is maybe not disadvantaged to you or doesn't do you personally negative harm, right?
Right.
But what would you normally think of being a truly honest person? For me, the definition is, you know what, they're going to tell you the truth, regardless of whether it's in their best interest or not. You know, and that's the kind of gold bar I kind of set. Do I reach it? I'm practical with myself. No, but I'd like to think that I'm better at it and I'm more transparent. So I'm kind of reaching where I want to get to, but I'm also human. So, yeah, you know, do you tell the white lie?
Yeah. It sounds like this whole behavioral approach that people in this pandemic who are struggling, they're probably thinking, well, I have nothing. I'm just going to continually spend. I'm going to take this stimulus money. I'm going to spend it. I know that look at the alcohol consumption. Hasn't that increased over the pandemic?
You know, there's actually statistical evidence that actually shows. So, I mean, if there's anything, usually what ends up happening is during even bad economics, so during the trough, so when the economy is not moving, and this is that correlation that I mentioned before, causation, actually alcohol sales goes up. Alcohol sales go up in economically difficult times. And there's actually statistical evidence for it.
And that's why I'm saying, go ahead. I don't want to interject. My brain's going all over the place.
No, it is. And it's that's why this topic can lead you in so many different interesting areas because, I mean, ultimately, and kind of simplify it and kind of reset the conversation a little bit.
Yeah, go for it.
We're humans and you can never strip out the behavioral aspect of it. But not everyone believes that. So when you start referring to academia, they make an overly simplifying assumption that people are rational and they'll always maximize their utility. What I'm saying is, I don't think you can make such a simplifying assumption. Things look great in ag. And another thing is they do these things in aggregate. The average person does this. The average this does that.
Yeah.
But we're all unique. Where do we sit in that average, right? The average family has 2.2 kids.
So true.
How do you have 0.2 of a child, right? So it's those types of, you have to understand a little bit how they, even economists, and it's just more to understand or get the drive home the point, the human aspect's always involved. What academia and even financial institutions will tell you is always motivated by some other interests. So you have, and that's actually the basic concept or why when you asked me if I was interested in this talk, is to say, yes, Dave, because I think financial literacy is the responsibility for all of us to have. And it kind of answers your question.
Yeah, it does. So where do we, because you said we're kind of being conned. So where does it start? How do we begin to educate ourselves?
They can listen to your podcast.
Well, that's one.
This is a great,
yeah, I guess.
You know, I think a lot of times what people, what I've seen is, at least for myself, is what's always caused me delay in either learning something new. I think we all struggle with time. No, I don't have time for this. I don't have time for that. You know what? Up to a certain point, I understand that. But the question I ask myself is, well, how important is financial literacy to me or to anyone? And if the answer is yes, then people have to make time. They don't have to become financial experts. It's more of how do you know for the retail, when you walk into a branch, is what the person across the table from me, is what they're saying accurate, or can it even be accurate? There are certain things that if you know how the system works, you can immediately spot saying that cannot be possible. Other things you're going to have to.
You know what, Girardi? I don't even think people care to know how it works. And the reason why I say that is in Canada, we have what was called in 2009 a TFSA, tax-free savings account. And I was speaking with a colleague a few years ago. This person had no idea what a TFSA even was and didn't even care. So the point is, like, this is what I'm saying. There's so much. Remember how I said stir in a little bit of people's ignorance? And remember what I told you about they don't even feel the necessity because they're still comfortable? I don't have faith. Do you have faith that people are going to actually start to learn about their finances?
You know, I actually asked one of our colleagues, I think, I'm not going to throw out the name, but we went to high school with him as well. But he's a professor down in the US, so I think you know who I'm speaking of. And when I was doing my Master of Finance, one of the things that irritated me in the classroom is that You know, it was a fairly diverse age group, but most of the class were, you know, the 20-somethings. And there were a few of us that were a little bit on the higher spectrum of the age group. And what I found frustrating is that I knew I was there. I knew the importance of why I paid all that money to learn, you know, to get a master's degree. Hearing the comments of some of the younger people on, you know, some of it can be just chalked off to, yes, you're young, you're ignorant, you know, maybe you don't understand the realities of how the world may work. You know, life quickly gives you slaps throughout your journey, right? To say, well, no, you may think things work this way, but welcome to the real world, those types of things. And the reason I'm giving you such a long-winded answer is to say, I asked this professor down in the US, because I out of a 30 class cohort, I think there was, you know, conservatively, maybe there was 10 of us that were really interested there in learning, as opposed to just getting a mark. And I think you can probably speak to that. It's,
that's education now. That's education today. Get the mark. I don't really care what I'm learning. Just want to get the mark. What's my mark?
And exactly that. And you know what? I was actually having conversations with other, so sort of finished my conversation with our US friend. I asked him, I said, how many people, when you're giving lectures in class, how many, do you get a fee to read on how many of your students actually are there to genuinely learn as opposed to just getting a mark? And his feedback, I mean, it's just one data point. So, I mean, take it for that.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, you know, Girardi, he said, he goes, I'm lucky if maybe 5% of my class actually cares enough to really either learn more or actually are there for the learning. But it's every industry regarding academia. You know, I started off with this blurb about my, you know, the NDAs and my disclosure statements. It's, there are always practical limitations, or at least, you know, he's bound by, you know, in academia, it's tenure. Tenure is the important thing. And if you're not tenured, a lot of your decision on whether they renew your contract for teaching is feedback from students. So it's always that, well, how hard are you on your students to really drive home to say, I'm gonna really focus more on the learning aspect versus the low grade, right? I mean, it's just natural human behavior to say if you're giving out D's to most of your class, the feedback is not gonna be great on you.
Right. So if I could, do you want to finish on that point, and then I'll synthesize and kind of wind down?
Definitely, because I mean, it's a long-winded way of saying the older I get, the more frustrating it is to see how people don't or are unwilling, or unwilling.
They don't, because like I said, I don't think there's that impetus there yet.
You know, it's not, but the thing is, you know, it's this whole thing about how things don't happen linearly in practice.
Right.
So you may think you have enough time, you know, they say get ahead, you know, there's usually the anecdotal phrases that say get ahead of the curve or you're going to fall behind the curve. And that's a really simplified way of saying things happen perhaps out of sequence than what you expected, or even perhaps more dangerously, there's that exponential curve. So it's not that things happen in a specific gradual way. It may happen gradually up to a point, and then all of a sudden it just skyrockets. And now you're no man's land, and oh, I didn't see this coming. So
which is where I want to go now, if I can end, because that's why I said in the beginning, I think this is a two-parter. I mean, we can go on for another 2 hours. But I want to kind of condense it, and speaking on that linear and then it takes off. Do you think that this pandemic has exposed the cracks in our current financial system, and will it ostensibly eradicate the middle class and you're going to have these elites and these poor? And that's what it's going to be moving forward. It's a tough question. It's a tough question. And I'm just curious as to what you think.
I think what the current, you know, the pandemic, the current economic situation, whether you want to say it's if you've worked in the profession, you know that these cracks have always existed. It's how you work in the education system, so you know the cracks in your system. You know, you speak to someone in another profession, you know, every industry has cracks in it. So if you were to ask me as a financial professional, you know, quasi technology person, I'd say these cracks were always there. I think the average person is now seeing them.
Okay. Now, do you think it's going to, like I said, kind of, we're no longer going to have a middle class, and it's just going to be bunch of haves and have nots?
You know, the shortest way I can answer that, Dave, is to say, I think the erosion of the middle class has been a long time in happening. So it's not,
it's not all of this event that you're saying it's been happening.
It's been happening over multiple decades.
Right, right.
And I think it's just, I think when you get into crisis situations, it perhaps for that time, it maybe accelerates it slightly.
Yeah.
So is it accelerating the inequality? And, you know, generally that's what it's framed as, the general inequality in our economy. I think we've been globally just shifting more to the haves and have nots. And that middle class, you know, that I grew up in, you grew up in, has been eroding over time. Okay. The reason for it, I mean, we could spend another 4 hours, you know, discussing why it's happened, but I think it's been a long time happening. And
but that's what I want to, if I can have you on again down the line, that's what I want to focus on. Like, have a topic on that. What you just said right now about this middle class eroding.
I'd be happy to come back, David. I think maybe we can even segment this, because a lot of what we've been talking about right now has been more in the economic theory space rather than financial services and what will help the average person.
Yeah.
But I think this lays a good framework, because there's a lot of, just like learning anything, there's always a prerequisite or some information you need to know ahead of learning what you actually want to learn.
Okay. So then maybe this will have to be a three-parter, Girardi. Maybe you're going to have to come on two more times.
If you can put up with me, Dave, I'm happy to come back.
All right, let's wind down now. And I know you've heard some of the other episodes, so you kind of know what I do. I kind of like to end on a light note. And we're going to get into our Guess What segment. So what you're going to do today, you're going to play a game called Money Pit. You're going to have 100 seconds to cross over 8 elevators or pits. And you're going to get 2 pit passes. There are 3 pits on this trail. You don't know which elevator number the pits are in. I do. So you're going to have 2 elevator pit passes. Which numbers would you like in the 1, 2 to 8? Okay. Remember, there's 3 traps, we'll call them. You don't know where they are, but you can get 2 pit passes. Which numbers?
Let's give me number 3 and number 7, Dave.
3 and 7. I like it, Girardi. Those are good choices, brother.
Let's hope they help me out.
All right. So I'm gonna put a hundred seconds on the clock. Guess
what?
The Great Recession, the most recent worldwide economic downturn, started in what year?
2008.
Correct. You're at number 1. The Nobel Prize in Economics in 2014 was awarded to which economist?
Are there any passes in this?
Yeah, you could pass.
Pass.
Okay. In 2014, this economist became the first woman appointed as chair of the Federal Reserve in the United States.
Yellen.
Yes.
Janet.
You're at number 3. Was that your pit pass? Go. Next, you're at number 4. Yes. The country that has the largest income per person as measured by GDP in U.S. dollars starts with an L.
Luxembourg?
Yes. You're on to number 5, and that's a pit. We go down. If you get the answer right, I stop the clock. I bring you back up. The most recent hyperinflation, where the percent increase in the general price level inflation exceeds 1,000% per year, occurred in which country?
Holland.
No, Zimbabwe. The latest round of trade negotiations among members of the World Trade Organization is known as?
World Trade Organization?
Doha. That's a hard one. Which European country does not use the euro as its main currency? You have 30 seconds left.
Country, UK.
Yes. Name the 2001 event that led to the bankruptcy of U.S. energy company and resulted in the dissolution of Arthur Andersen, one of the top 5 U.S. accounting firms.
That was Enron.
Yes, go to 6. Who was the economist that identified massive vulnerability in the U.S. banking system and predicted its collapse 3 years before the Great Recession occurred? An increase from 5 to 8% in interest rate charged by banks would most likely encourage what?
Savings.
Yes. What is the measure of how consumers react to a change in price?
Are you talking about inflation rate?
Yes. What is opportunity cost?
The choice given up to pursue another choice.
Yes, 7 pit pass. Last one. As prices go up, what goes down?
Assumptions.
With regards to determinants of supply, loose government regulation tends to do what?
Oh, increases demand.
Yes.
All right. Wow, that was you're bringing it back with education days.
That was tough, wasn't it?
Brutality.
It was. You know what? I'm not very good on.
And you know what? The pressure of time, but I was lax on the time. It's all good. This is just to have fun and let the listeners enjoy. Yeah. And it was tough. It was tough. And I do want to say, since this was such a difficult topic, are there any simplified book recommendations that you could make for listeners to just get, let's say, just to start out? Like you said, this episode laid a foundation.
You know what? Let me send you something, Dave, and then maybe you can provide that a link on your on
yeah,
your
I
site.
Will on the website. Yeah,
definitely. I can throw you off a few of them. That's a good primer.
And then I'll put it up. And if the listeners want to do the work, they can go to the website and they can take a look at that resource.
Sounds great, Dave.
Any final thoughts before we leave here? Because you were amazing, and this is, like I said, I can't emphasize this enough. This is so complicated, so many moving parts. Are there any final words you want to leave the listeners with?
Perhaps the main thing that, I guess the main takeaway is, don't be discouraged to start your learning path within how the financial system works. It can be very daunting when you think you have to start, but it's that first step. I'm actually hoping that we've encouraged them. I mean, even if we can get a small number of them to even pick up a book or say, let me just read up a little bit on this so I can be a little bit more intelligent on this topic than I was yesterday. Yeah. They're not going to learn everything that you need to know, but you don't need to know that as the average person. So just keep that in context within everything we chatted about today. It is very complex, but the nice thing is that there are a lot of resources available today that make it a little bit easier for people just to learn a little bit more than what they knew previously.
And don't have to be, you don't want to be destitute by the time you start learning. Learn now. Small. Baby steps.
You know, it is. I mean, it's the same thing. You know, I started off on this whole journey. I mean, I think you know me. I was never really big in education early in my life. And, you know, I was more into sports, more into athletics. And, you know, I caught the education bug late in life.
Yep.
And maybe it was a positive thing. Maybe I have more energy to learn nowadays because I didn't, you know, I kind of shied away from it earlier in my life.
Right.
But with the one thing I quickly learned was, if you can find it, this is more of a necessity for people, I believe, but you'll be very surprised at how interesting the material is. And there's going to be a small amount of your audience that'll likely take this to another level. So
I agree.
So I'm hoping that we at least change one person's viewpoints on this. I would consider that a success. You know, you start with small numbers and that person just keeps spreading that message. And I think that's ultimately how you invoke change.
And that's a recurring theme on this podcast, where I say, if we can even get one person inspired, then we've done our job.
You know, I think I may have taken that quote from you as well, because I mean, listening to some of your podcasts, I know how big you are a believer. And I think we've chatted about this before.
Yeah.
I think it always comes back to the person themselves. And I think people are stronger and more intelligent. And if they can just overcome those fears and those, they'll be pleasantly surprised and they'll start to learn that, you know what, invoking change is not as difficult as they would have thought it was.
Amazing.
And it becomes a habit, actually. It becomes a habit. And you actually almost become addicted to it, right?
It's, absolutely.
You know, so I will just end it on that note. Otherwise, Dave, I'll keep talking for another half hour.
Girardi, my brother, I appreciate you coming on. And like I said, there are many topics that we left unexplored. So I'm hoping that we could do this again.
Mr. Tucci, if you have me back, I'm happy to come back.
All right, brother. Thanks so much.
All right. You enjoy the rest of the day and happy Halloween. I hope it was good for you and the kids yesterday.
Well, the kids didn't get to go, so it's all good.
Okay.
All right, brother. Take care.
All right. You too.
If philosophy is fundamental and it is the medicine for the mind, then finance is foundational.
It is the bridge you walk across each day of your life. So build a sturdy bridge. A rickety bridge is a scary prospect to navigate. But it's up to you. You are accountable. And only you can begin the learning journey. Mr. Girardi is certainly correct in saying that the habit, if you create it, becomes addictive. I used to watch a lot of sports and realized quickly that the satisfaction viewing sports brings me pales in comparison to the satisfaction I get from immersing myself in finance. Just start somewhere. Maybe start with the resources I will post that Mr. Girardi will send me. It's never too late to solidify your foundation. We got through another episode, and I hope you found value in it. If so, please subscribe, like the podcast, leave a review, and don't forget this week's crazy karaoke from earlier. We are on a 3-win shout-out streak, so let's keep it going. Next week, we're going to keep it light and keep it interesting, as I will be bringing on a wine expert, and we will be talking about the exploration of winemaking. That's it for me. I'll be back with you all next week. Enjoy the rest of your day, the rest of your week, and remember to always add, you got it, a little funk to your day. We'll be right back.